TFM.
Fun will now commence.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Journey, our dedicated Star Trek Voyager podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I have some bad news today.
Oh, no.
It turns out that your brain is not on file.
What? I thought I registered that.
Well, you'd think someone would tell the doctor or the co-host, but, you know, I'm set out on the podcast of the damned, apparently.
Oh, well, I mean, I could have sworn that, I don't know, was that the was that the 1513 or was that the 1583 that needed to be turned in? I don't know. I get those numbers mixed up.
Me too. But what I don't get mixed up is that we are doing a 30th anniversary rewatch of Star Trek Voyager, and this is episode 3 of season 1, Time and Again. And here's a quick rundown of the story. A planet orbiting a red dwarf presents a mystery that Janeway cannot resist, so Voyager makes a pit stop to investigate. She and Tom Paris beam to the surface and discover a timepiece that has stopped working, seemingly indicating the moment that an explosion destroyed all life. Believing there is nothing left to do, they prepare to return to the ship when the world around them suddenly changes. They've jumped back in time one day before the disaster to a place where a singular color palette rules. So, Matthew, I guess our starting point can just be a little bit of Counting Crows, you know? Time and time again. The writers
time
are playing with time again.
You know,
I'd love to see Cyndi Lauper.
Yes.
And Counting Crows together.
Right? There you go. Oh, my gosh.
That'd be fantastic. But I don't know if it would be as fantastic as another time travel story to kick off Star Trek Voyager at a time when there was so much time travel in Star Trek. So this comes right off the heels of Parallax, which the writers were playing with time. We also, around this time, had Generations. We had All Good Things. So, I mean, my question to you would be, are the writers going to the well too many times?
Well, Chris, we don't have time to talk about time because we just don't have the time. So that's our show for everyone. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If we get here before the show starts, maybe we'll do it again.
Yeah, it's I think this was definitely the wrong time for them to go to the time well, because the time well was pretty dry. And I think that it's clearly time for them to think of another idea than this one, because it was interesting coming back into this episode because I didn't remember having great feelings for it, but I didn't really necessarily remember the entire story, you know, coming in because it's been so long since I'd seen it. But I just left this one thinking they're truly in that place where they have to fill a lot of space for these seasons, even though Voyager ends up being only a 16 episode season. I think it was cut short because like of a writer's strike or something.
My memory is always that this one followed the same pattern as Deep Space Nine, which it just premiered in January, and therefore it had a shorter season. Yeah.
All that to say, this episode definitely feels like, okay, we need a Star Trek episode, and we need it to happen on this show, and go.
A good place to start when you're three episodes out of the gate on a new series, right?
And, you know, I think the thing about this is that when you think of them doing the time travel episode again, it's like if you need to do a bottle show, right? Mm-hmm. If you need the show to be more about characters, we'll find an interesting way on the ship, you know, just you don't even have to go anywhere. You know, I mean, Deep Space Nine kind of showed that, right? That you don't have to go anywhere to tell really interesting stories. And I think that, you know, when you think of where this series started and the characters that are coming together with the Maquis, with the Starfleet crew, and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you could easily create an interesting scenario here on the ship where they're, or maybe it's like, okay, we've got to find deuterium somewhere, you know, and so we need to find an asteroid belt or, you know, any kind of story like that where it just creates an opportunity then for, you know, certain crew members to need to work together. So you you continue the process of building this crew into one. But yeah, I mean, for me, I think going to the Well of Time was not well served, I think, for the episode, especially three episodes in, and especially since you had just done an episode where, like you mentioned, we were already playing with time and parallax. And so, and then I think there's a host of other reasons too why this episode as well just kind of lets you down the further you get into it. And a lot of that has to do with other stuff that we'll talk about. But I don't know, what what did you end up thinking about this idea? Because, you know, again, we're three episodes in. As you're coming into the series the first time, is this kind of what you're hoping for?
Yeah. Well, first, I just want to say, I'm pretty sure I went to the Well of Time last night when I was playing The Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom. I think that's it's one of the side quests, I think.
Yeah.
But got to get the trousers of time out of the treasure chest. So, I mean, for me, this one, I'm probably not the best person to critique the overuse of time travel in stories because I love time travel stories. So I always enjoy playing with time in science fiction. And when I go back now and I watch this episode, I don't watch it in the context of where is it falling on the timeline of production and how many time travel stories have I seen just before I watched this one. If I think back to when this first aired in 1995, as I mentioned when we discussed Caretaker, to get Voyager, I had to get VHS tapes from my dad. Yep. And we had gone up to Birmingham to see Generations and then get the tape of Caretaker from him. And my viewing of all these episodes was delayed a little bit because of this process. But it was that time where, for people watching this, I mean, people had just been going to see Generations in the theater, and then they're seeing these two time travel stories on Voyager just right around the same time at the beginning of that year. So it is something that people noticed and fans did comment on. Even Jeri Taylor herself said that she wishes they had done this story in the second season, not right out of the gate.
Okay, like, yeah, I can see that.
I think the concept of this story for me is interesting. I'm not sure that it was executed well in addition to the timing of it, which we can discuss more.
Completely agree.
Seeds of this story are interesting from a science fiction writing point of view. And that is that they wanted to build a story that had some connection to the situation anyway of the bombing of Dresden during World War II and ask the question of, and you sort of, you know, hit on this a moment ago, or maybe it was on the other side of the quadrant when we were talking beforehand, but if you were there 24 hours before the bombing and you knew it was coming, what would you do?
Right.
And so in this situation, if Voyager had never gone to this planet, what would have happened in the first place, right? Are they responsible for what happened? And it reminds me of some other stories like Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse Five, which, you know, Vonnegut was a prisoner of war in Dresden, was there when it was firebombed. And so in Slaughterhouse Five, the main character has this experience that parallels that. Also, Connie Willis, a science fiction author that I love, a lot of her stories deal with World War II and time-traveling historians. So all that kind of popped in my head when I'm thinking about the basic concept of this. So I think that the question being raised in the episode is an interesting one. And for that reason, I kind of like, I've always liked this episode, even if it's not one of the best executed episodes of Star Trek.
I think that's really interesting. And I'm okay with a good time travel story. I mean, you know, I personally have great affection for, you know, something like First Contact. I think that that's a fantastic Star Trek movie. I think it's a great time travel type of story. I think that's excellent. You know, I mean, obviously we all love Star Trek IV. There's other great Star Trek time travel stories that really I can't think play interestingly with time. Something like The Inner Light is probably one of the best examples of playing with time in a way that is so unique that, you know, really allows you to have an incredible experience for a character, but within the confines you know, playing with time. But it's not a traditional time travel story, right? And so,
Well, another great one on Voyager, which we'll get to later, but just since we're bringing it up, is Before and After, when Kes is getting, like, aging in reverse.
I remember that one.
And then the fact that they go back to it later on with Year of Hell, and it all ties together. Like, you know, Voyager does time travel stories very well.
Yeah.
Later on when they get the rest of the show settled in a bit more.
Well, and I think, so, you know, one of the reasons, though, that possibly this episode might not work out that well is that in many ways, this feels such a generic Star Trek story, as we already mentioned. It could happen on just about any of the Star Trek series, you know. But I also think that, and I did look this up to confirm that I was right, but watching the episode, I was just struck by how constrained the budget felt. And the creation of this new world and everything, and it just felt like we were trapped in a bad space mall. And then, you know, they have those places where they're filming outdoors, and it's clearly done in a way where there's, I mean, this is way before you're augmenting real life to truly make it look spacey, you know.
Oh, that kind of augmenting. Okay. I thought we were going to bring, you know, like Khan and his guys.
No, not those
and his,
augments.
And his gang in.
But, you know, one of as a good example, one of the beauties of Star Wars Andor is that much of that show is either built on stages that they created outdoors, they created these massive sets that you could walk around and you feel like you're lost in the city, or they would go to real places all over the United Kingdom, and then they would augment them with CGI to create a otherworldly Star Wars-like feel, you know? So we're in these real places on our planet, and yet you just feel like we're on our planet. There's nothing special about them. And so there's this whole sense, I feel like, of the production here of just kind of being on the wrong footing from the beginning, in the sense that we can't afford to be doing this episode in the first place the way they kind of wanted to. Two, this isn't necessarily maybe the best idea. And three, this also goes to your point about the execution of the story. And one of the biggest problems with the execution here, I feel like, is just the production in general. It's just not appealing.
Yeah.
And I think that's a real problem.
This point shows that this episode has a lot of parallels with a very famous first season episode of Deep Space Nine, Move Along Home. Because it was the same situation where the original vision for Move Along Home would have required something totally different with the sets, and they couldn't do it. It's too expensive. And they ended up watering down the story. And, you know, that episode also could have played quite differently if they were able to do it the way they had originally envisioned it. You know, this one, Michael Piller talks about they wanted to build two distinct sets outdoors and they can go back and forth between the two. And then he realized, oh, there's no way we're going to do that. And you said you get off on the wrong footing, Move Along Home. You don't want to get off on the wrong footing during one of those chunks.
Oh no. Alan Moraine
or you're out of the game.
Yeah, so, you're just all the way out. You know what I'm saying? But no, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, again, this does feel like, I don't know if it's a constrained nature of, you know, trying to have so many episodes for a season or anything like that, but it just feels like you said, this shouldn't be the third episode of the series. You know, and the other part of this is, in some ways, where this episode is placed, there aren't any true markers for it in the sense of like it needing to be where it is. So, I mean, make this episode later on in the season.
Yeah.
Allow, you know, because the next episode, I believe, is the Phage, or just Phage. And so allow that, you know, to be the next episode, because that is an episode where we meet an interesting alien race, you know, that we don't do anywhere else in Star Trek. We kind of create a race that we'll see multiple times throughout the series. And that's kind of an interesting thing to do, I think, for your third episode, because it hits you with, oh yeah, we're in the Delta Quadrant. And this is stuff that doesn't happen on the other side of the quadrant, you know, in the Alpha and Beta quadrants and the Gamma quadrant. So let's do that, you know, and we instead do this episode where it's like, yeah, if you really nailed this one, I think it would be great. But you know, I don't know if they nail it. And another question I have for you, Chris, is what are they doing there?
Right?
Just in general, like the way the episode begins, they scan this planet and it's dead. And they have, you know, there's this radiation. But why are they there? Like, what purpose does it serve for them to go find out why these people died? Why not just catalog it and move on?
Because this is Voyager, Matthew, and although you've got a long trip home,
it's true.
You got to investigate everything you see, right? It's like, I mentioned Zelda earlier. You know, on YouTube, they have that that channel where they do the honest trailers. They do honest movie trailers and honest. The honest trailer for Breath of the Wild is so funny because they mention that one of the things you do in the game is to take everything you can get your hands on because you're just collecting every tiny thing in the game. And Voyager feels a little bit like that to me as well, where like every little thing they detect, well, we got to go investigate.
Well,
but it's already going to take us 70 years to get home, right? Oh, I know, but trust me, this detour, it's only going to take us like 15 minutes and we can get back on our way.
Here's the interesting reason. Okay, look, if you said that there's some sort of system on the ship that could use polaric energy to charge it back up, say like the replicators or something like that, I think that would make this incredibly interesting, and it would immediately make the episode feel more needed, right? Because there's a reason for us then to stop, you know, but to scan a dead planet and the fact that there's polaric radiation in the atmosphere and the entire planet's gone, I mean, there's absolutely no reason for a Janeway to have set them down on this planet in the first place. They should have just passed it by. And so you needed to create then a reason for them to stop, because otherwise, again, that's my thought process of, we need then to, again, if we're constrained by budget because we've been spending too much money on the last, you know, three episodes, because you got the opener and then which is a two-parter, and then you've got your next episode with just Parallax, and you got to save some money. It's like, well, this is a great time to just have this be a bottle episode on the ship where we're traveling between systems, and it's all about the character dynamics. It's all about the story with Paris and Harry and him trying to get them to go on a date, and like seeing that dynamic of people starting to like, do we hook up or do we not hook up? Because are we going to be here forever or not? You know, I mean, there's so many interesting dynamics that I think you could explore that don't need you to stop on a dead world and create a problem of your own making.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that stood out to me rewatching the episode for this discussion. It's been a while since I've seen it, is that we do get mention of the Prime Directive in here. And unlike Caretaker, where Janeway and Tuvok bring up the Prime Directive and she's got to make this decision, and there's a legitimate reason for it to be mentioned that, yeah, we are going to be affecting, you know, we didn't ask to be pulled here, but we're here now and we're caught in the middle of this situation.
Exactly, yeah.
This is a case where they went here on their own. No one asked them to come here. So it's sort of like, yeah, you're creating a problem that you then need to solve where you shouldn't even be there in the first place.
And especially, you know, this doesn't help you get home. This doesn't have anything you need,
right?
You know? And so I think all of that is, as we think about this, is the stuff where it's just like, okay, you needed in the script to have a reason for them to be there. And if you've done that, I think, again, if you had a reason that Polarica Energy is important on Voyager because of their, you know, bio-gelled, you know, neuron packs or whatever they are.
Bio-neural
gel packs, you know, that help run the ship. Dude, that's a great thing, right? Like, that tells us something about this new technology that we don't know. I mean, so what it really does feel like is this episode needed maybe a few more passes then in the script development. I do have this is a question I also have for you, though. We're three episodes into Voyager.
Mm-hmm.
Does it feel like they understand the mandate of the show that they've already created? Because we felt like the first episode and the second episode wasn't bad. You know, we gave it a good rating because of the character dynamic stuff. But, like, does it feel like that this show clearly has created, I mean, you know, Deep Space Nine, three episodes in, you were like, oh yeah, this is not TNG, right?
Mm-hmm.
Does this show feel like it's creating for itself what you'd want, which is its own sense of being, like its own sense of purpose, like its own identity?
It's a difficult question because,
obviously, you know the answer, you know, because we know the future, but yes.
Yeah, yeah. Referencing Deep Space Nine, I agree that the first few episodes out of the gate, you felt like, okay, yeah, this is not the next generation, especially because of Emissary and what happens in that story. However, I think that the general feeling about Deep Space Nine season one is that it starts to feel a bit confused itself about.
Yeah, sometimes it does.
Is this a new show? Is this the next generation? What are we doing here? And I say the general feeling because, as you and I know, as Niners who have gone back and rewatched it and discussed it over and over and over and over, you really do start to find very distinct differences between Deep Space Nine during season one and the Next Generation, but it's not obvious on the surface. And I think Voyager is following a similar pattern at this point.
Yeah. I can
like,
see that.
I don't think that Parallax and Time and Again are completely inappropriate for the premise of the show.
Sure. Yeah.
But I think that Parallax makes a bit more sense because just traveling through space, they've gotten caught up in the situation and they've got to figure out how to get out of it and keep going. This one, they go out of their way to get in trouble when they should have just kept going. But of course, if they just keep going all the time, the series is not going to be very interesting. So they do have to go and get into things. It's hard to say at this point, just three episodes in, whether I feel like the writers understand or don't understand the mandate that they've given themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that Time and Again was not the right foot to put forward in your third outing to show that, hey, this is a different show, because this episode could work 100% on the Next Generation and it would feel very natural as a Next Generation episode. There's nothing about it that needs to be on the other side of the galaxy for something like this to happen. And what you say about the Polaric energy and make that something that they need, you know, that's the core hook that you need in the episode.
Yep,
and it's something
exactly.
that Voyager starts to do later on, where like they need something. And so they're going to go to this planet because they think they can find a particular thing that might help them get home faster, or, you know, they have a reason to interact with people a little bit more. I think about something like the rebooted Battlestar Galactica, where like they need water.
Yeah.
And so they're searching for planets where they can get water, and then they get in trouble. But like they have a legitimate reason for going to these places because, well, they don't get water, they're all going to die. Right.
Yeah.
Voyager's not going to, the crew's not going to die if they don't get Polaric energy. Right.
Well, and I think, again, that thinking of, okay, we've been thrown on the other side of the galaxy. The ship has kind of been damaged in the fight with the Kazon, as well as, you know, this whole thing with the array.
Mm-hmm.
Having an episode then where you're repairing the ship from also maybe the experience in Parallax, and mm-hmm. you're looking for a planet that supplies you with some sort of mineral or something.
Mm-hmm.
And the episode really then allows you, and this is what I'd say, allows you then to focus on the character dynamics. And if you do that, I think, especially with the Maquis members and the Starfleet members, if you did that and you allowed that to kind of, that the experience of overcoming this need for whatever it is, I think that might help a lot of people not feel like they just kind of brush that idea under the rug, mm-hmm. because the first three episodes, you're really dealing with that, and you're giving them resolution to that kind of story or whatever. And mm-hmm. then you can kind of move into the other parts of the story that you're going to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I think that would have been a benefit then for the show. But I mean, even here, mm-hmm. you know, I think we've come up with a plausible reason why this story could have existed as it is, but just add a reason for them actually needed to be on this planet.
Yeah, I mean, that would be an easy fix for the story. Just something simple like that. Now, what you describe, I think, is something that you and I would love, that type of story, repairing the ship, kind of dealing with the aftermath of how the caretaker incident has affected everybody. But for Star Trek fans overall, and especially jump back in time and think about 1995, where we've come out of the Next Generation, we've had Generations in the theater, we've got Deep Space Nine going, now we've got Voyager going. Just what fandom was like at the time and what fans expect from Star Trek, do you think that would have worked? Or do you think the writers are reading the room and understand that, well, what fans really want from Star Trek is not that level of realism?
I think that they're not thinking enough about how to look. Anytime talking to a friend of mine who has worked on shows and is a writer as well, has written episodes for shows. Anytime that you, like, you have to know what the rules of the universe are in, that you're in, before you can bend or break them.
Yeah. Oh,
and I feel like the problem here is that they're not trying to bend or break anything. They're just doing mm-hmm. more of the same.
Yeah, like, exactly.
And so I feel like maybe pushing the audience a little bit by bending or some of what we're used to by mm-hmm. creating a show that creates an identity then for Voyager in that way, I think people could have responded well to mm-hmm. that, because it would have given them something to really gravitate towards, right? It would have like, it would have created a specific identity. And two, like, one of the beauties that Voyager should have, right, is the idea that we don't know how long we're going to be here. So this ship mm-hmm. goes from being a crew to family in a way mm-hmm. that all the other shows, yes, TNG, and of course, even Deep Space Nine, right, were, and then the original series. But this show should truly be a show where it's like, yeah, we're family, you know? Mm-hmm. And So to create those type of relationships, I think, you know, would be really interesting, which in some ways I think is what they're kind of trying to do in this episode when you think of like the dynamics. You've got Tom and Harry, that's the brother relationship. And then you've got Janeway and Tom, which is kind of this very maternal, you know, mother-son type of relationship in some ways. But I think there could be just maybe some more dynamic ways to approach that than the way we get here, which just feels very rote and routine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to that point, I think that as much as I loved the sheer volume of interconnected Star Trek that we were getting at this time in the 90s, I think that the pressure of all of these 26 episode seasons, I know this one's shorter, but if you take the overall Star Trek at the time, where you've got two shows in production overlapping all throughout that time, plus the movies, like, I think Michael Piller, Jerry Taylor, everyone involved in these shows are perfectly capable of creating something more than what we're seeing. But I feel like, and this is just speculation, this isn't based on comments that anyone has shared, I feel like everyone, and I know this because I work in media, I'm a magazine creator, and I've been doing magazines for more than 30 years, most of the time monthly, and so I know what a hamster wheel media production can be. And TV shows are obviously even far more complicated than magazines, and you're under this pressure of it. It's just unrelenting, and you finish one, and you're already working on the next one, and you can never catch your breath. And in that environment, I think you sometimes get stories like this, where you've got to push out the next one, or even the studio's telling you, "Okay, we've got to have a new series, not just a new episode, but we've got to have a new series." And it's got to launch at this time. And as a creative, like, you can't be your best because you don't have time. You think back to when Enterprise aired and Rick Berman was asking the studio, like, we need a little bit of a break before we go into the next one. You know, let's really think about this. But they're like, no, we've got to, you know, Voyager's going to be over. We got to get the next one out. So I do wonder if that's a little bit of what is going on here, where there's just so much Star Trek being produced.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
They needed to be able to step back and kind of refresh, catch their breath, and then move forward. So I want to talk about the characters a little bit. And you touched on, you know, Janeway, the family element. Parallax was very much about Janeway's relationship with B'Elanna and also with Chakotay. This one focuses a lot on her and Tom down on the planet. But one other thing that I feel like, maybe when we go back to the polaric energy part, which it doesn't connect, but I just wonder what they were trying to hit on here with Kes. They're trying to develop Kes's character as some kind of unique alien right at the beginning of the series. And she's got this telepathic ability that her ancestors had, and it's surfacing in her. And the time loop aspect of the story and what draws them to the planet also, because there's this, the fact that there was a civilization, there is a civilization, and then Kes is sensing all of this. That's another case where I think they're trying to shove a lot of character development early into the season, but it's not really connecting with the story in a way where they could have specifically had this polaric energy thing causing Kes to have these visions, which I think is not what they actually end up doing, right?
Yeah, I agree. I do think the storyline with Kes here, I think you rightly pinpointed, it just feels slightly forced into the episode, and it doesn't feel as organic as you'd want it to.
But it could connect really well if they had written it that way.
I agree. And yet, I'm also torn because I think really the main thrust of the story should just be the relationship between Tom and Janeway, because you get the sense here is that, and what I love about this is that, you know, we know that Tom's dad is an admiral. He's grown mm-hmm. up on what he calls, you know, the yearly sermon on, you know, like he went to Starfleet Easter and got the sermon on the prime directive. And, you know,
can you imagine the eggs that Neelix would make for Starfleet Easter egg?
I mean, can you touch them? Can you not touch them? You know, where did they come from? Are they from a pre-warp civilization? It's all very frustrating to be a
like
kid.
Like if you gather these eggs, some civilization might cease to exist on the other side of the galaxy.
I can't touch these eggs. And so I think that all that's so interesting, right? And I think what it does is it actually creates this really interesting dynamic where in some ways, Janeway can be Tom's way back in to Starfleet ideals.
Yeah.
By her giving him a actual example, by her being, you know, to put it kind of in a spiritual phrase, a good witness for Starfleet ideology. And yet, we don't get that in this episode because the episode should just really kind of be focused on them and mm-hmm. then trying to get them back, I think. Mm-hmm. And so there should be a lot more time between them kind of going back and forth with their discussion, mm-hmm. which they start, but they never really actually get a chance to kind of develop. And I think that's the thing here in some ways. It's almost like you said, they have all of these ideas of, oh, we could do this with Kes, and oh, we could do this with – and it's like this is one of those places where you need to figure out what the core of the story is, and then everything needs to work around that. I mean, like the whole idea of is this Dresden and you knew a day before – okay, that's interesting, I think, kind of.
I think it's interesting.
But also, okay, this also could play into maybe you're talking about, as Star Trek likes to do, maybe you're talking about how do humans get their energy and making us trying to think about that idea. But they don't even really hit on that in the episode, you know. So my point in all of that is, It comes down to what is the core of this episode. And the core of this episode should be the relationship between Janeway and Tom being kind of won back over to Starfleet ideals. Because that's the interesting story there. Because Tom, you know, he's along for this ride because she got him out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
But his story arc is about becoming more than this kind of like playboy. And that would be a very interesting dynamic then to continue to play with. And this episode really developed. And unfortunately, like you mentioned, the episode is grasping at so many ideas. It's not actually servicing really any of them very well. Mm-hmm. Specifically, just even the character dynamics that they're trying to go for. Because this episode specifically, as I was reading, it was meant to be about Janeway and Tom's relationship. And yet, it gets really short shrift, I think. It just doesn't get the time, Chris, to develop.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I said Kes's storyline doesn't really connect with the episode. I mean, it is a setup in a sense because she has this vision. So then they become suspicious about, oh, this planet's in ruin. But then Kes actually sees things. But there are other ways that you could set that up, or if you're going to use Kes in that way, I feel like you need to tie it in more to the story. So I'm just going to tag that on there just to flesh out my thoughts on that element of the story.
Well, and then there's the whole other part of this episode where it's like, oh, now we have to touch on the fact that the Doctor still hasn't really been integrated into the staff. And it's just like, it's one more thing where that's great in the sense that they're actually building character development for the Doctor and the crew or whatever, but it's like it's also just one more part of the story that kind of deviates from the true core of the story.
Right. Which that is a good element of the series.
Yes.
And
Yes. 100%. I think, you know, again, there are places here where the episode is doing a good job in sense we're continuing mm-hmm. Harry and Tom and their relationship, right? I think that's great. Mm-hmm. We're actually touching on something that the show should be touching on, which is this mm-hmm. idea of like the relational aspect of this crew, which could never get home except for maybe 75 years or more. So that's mm-hmm. a big question. Yeah. And then the dynamic with the doctor, that's another great aspect we've already been touching on. So there are some good nuggets here.
Mm-hmm. Well, the element with the doctor in terms of the series, and especially you need to do it early in the series bit by bit, is that they're dealing with a human rights situation that is novel at the time that this was being done. I think today, when we think about the doctor dealing with AI as we are these days, the idea of how do we view a life form that's essentially a computer mm-hmm. program is different than it was in 1995. At the time that this came out, Star Trek for years and years had been dealing with the question of how do we view and how do we treat life forms that are different from us? You go all the way back to the Horda, which is a great example in the original series where it's something that's just so alien, we don't even realize mm-hmm. it's a sentient life form at first, right? And I think Voyager found a really nice way to do that with the holographic doctor, where people just dismiss him at first because he's just a computer program. But once he becomes an essential part of the crew, they really have to start figuring out, well, how do we integrate him into the crew and how do we treat him? Yes. And I think that's also where Kes's character works best on the show, is that she is also an outsider and she sees him in a different way because she isn't from the Starfleet tech background, right?
Completely agree.
But I think what you're pointing out here is that all of these elements, while they're good on their own, they're cluttering a story, which results in a muddy presentation where we miss the core and what's important in the story, and then actually nothing is really serviced well because there's just too much trying to be shoved into mm-hmm. this one.
And story. One more element, as you were saying that, I was also thinking, because I think that this really does hit the episode, and it was something that I kept thinking about as I was watching it. I was like, there is so much freaking techno babble in this episode. And it's too much. There's just way too much. And I think that's a disservice to the story. I think the story really did deserve I'm not going to generalize, but maybe this is something that could potentially become an issue in Voyager, where mm-hmm. they rely too heavily on technobabble to tell stories. Yeah. And I think definitely here it seems to me to be an incredible crutch that's actually hurting the episode, because you're having trouble kind of following all of the technobabble, you know?
Watching it this time,
it feels like, you know, Parallax too, where Tom was like, should I be understanding this? You know, and, you know,
right.
and
he's the audience, right?
Yeah. One also feels like, wait, should I be getting under what's going on here?
Yeah. 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 I was watching it this time, and I said out loud as I was watching it at one point, I was just repeating the lines in my own way, like, we need to tech the tech and tech the tech here, and then we'll tech the tech, because it's just like this string of technobabble that just kept going on.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
I don't mind technobabble in Star Trek. It gives Star Trek its character to some extent, but it can be overdone, and it was here, and it's actually an issue.
It felt like B'Elanna was wearing her Technicolor dream coat, you know? So
you mean her technobabble dream coat?
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, speaking of that, the last topic that I want to touch on, and ask you about. It's actually brought to us by the Eagles, because apparently on this planet, there's a shop in that bad space mall that we talked about called Just Another Tequila Sunrise, and they sell all the outfits.
That's what everybody's wearing is Tequila Sunrise.
They sell all the outfits on this planet. And I mean, you can get the order of the colors. Mm-hmm. There's some variety there. But otherwise, I mean, your choices are limited on this world.
I mean, it's a tequila sunrise in the Hotel California, because you can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. That's right. The other thing that I can't understand about the design work here is, one, we've talked about this many times. Star Trek has the terrible monoculture problem where every culture seems to all wear the exact same things. And it's not just this, right? I mean, it's all the way from, Klingons to Romulans to, Cardassians, I guess, in some ways kind of helped, because in Deep Space Nine, they truly let kind of Garak be his own character. Ferengi have a very interesting flamboyant style, so they're slightly different. So that's good. Oh my gosh, this, not only is this bad, but characters, I feel bad for this whole planet because everybody's in a corset. and I don't know if this, if we're stuck in like the Elizabethan era of this planet where everybody has to wear a corset, not just the women, but it's not a great look. And it is incredibly weird and loud in a way that it's very distracting. And so it's not actually helpful, I feel like, to the story you're trying to tell. So it's one of my least favorite costume designs for any series other than maybe the Kazon.
Yeah. No, it is. And that's something I remember from the very first time I saw the episode, was like, what's going on with the costume design here? Like, it does feel Star Trek. I'll give them that. But I mean, at least some color variety or something. It's just hard to believe. Imagine you visit Earth.
Yeah.
You land in any city on Earth. Are you going to see everybody wearing the same outfit or the same design with the colors in different orders, but everybody looks the same? Yeah. I mean, it's just not a realistic way to portray any world, because, unless it's the Borg and people have no personality at all.
Right? Well, and I mean, in some ways, this is an episode that feels so much like the original series in all the wrong ways, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, the original series was really constrained by budget.
Sure.
I think this is an episode where it's like, I should not. And the flamboyant costumes feel like the original series, but not in a good way.
Yeah. Well, the original series, everybody on the planet wore whatever costumes weren't being used that day by another TV show being filmed on the same lot, right? All right. No. Okay. Well, so I'm a little bit scared to ask this, but what are your final thoughts and what's your rating for this one, Matthew?
This is I was very high on the first two episodes. I actually thought that they did a great job. I thought it was really interesting. I liked Caretaker and I liked Parallax, right? I think I gave Parallax 3.5 stars. I think, unfortunately for this episode, though, it does come in at 2 out of 5 Polaric Ions, because it's just not firing on all cylinders. We are hitting the time well way too hard, and we have definitely hit rock bottom on the time well. And this episode just isn't, it's not that, and I think we've talked about it really well here in the sense that we've shown the different ways in which you could truly have made this episode feel better with just a couple of very minor tweaks, right?
Yeah.
And yet, this is just one of those episodes where the idea is not terrible, but the execution just doesn't quite hold up, and it lets the episode down. Mm-hmm. I do love the Paris-Kim dynamic. I love the stuff about the doctor. I do love that we're trying to build Janeway as a captain and her relationship with Tom. I love the thought process behind that, but I think the episode just can't live up to its own ideals and ideas. And so, yeah, it's got to be a 2 out of 5 for me here. But what about you, Chris?
Yeah, I'll keep mine short. I think it pretty much echoes what you said. I do think the concept of the story, the time travel aspect of the story, and the idea of, well, if you knew a day earlier that there was going to be a disaster, what would you do? I think that's a very interesting starting point for a story. Even though it's not original, as I mentioned, there are other science fiction stories who have played with the same thing. But that, coupled with the fact that I love time travel stories, makes this one that I'll still go back and rewatch, even though, as you say, it's not executed as well as it could be. I think we touched on today a lot of the little ways where, like, tweaks to the existing story could really make it a lot better. And it's too bad that they didn't do that. I do suspect that, as I said, the time pressures that everyone was under at this point in Star Trek's production had an impact on the quality of stories like this as well. So I'm going to give this one 4 demons who eat children and haven't had their supper yet.
Nice. Is that like out of 10?
Yeah, mine are usually out of 10.
Okay.
Although sometimes they're not. So
okay. All right. Yeah.
You know, my ratings going all the way back to children. Going all the way back to the start of the Ready Room, my ratings are very random. But yeah. You know what they say, 4 demons? Okay, 5 demons, that's a crowd. So you want to
Yeah.
You've heard that expression, right?
Sure. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Apparently, that's the other version of Screwtape Letters I haven't read. But anyway.
All right. Well, everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on Time and Again. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It is a closed group. It's just for listeners. It's there to extend the conversation beyond the podcasts. So please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll see a post on the timeline for this episode, and you can share your thoughts with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. You can also send us email if you like. Go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show and choose to the journey, and that'll come to Matthew and me by email. And of course, you can find us in social media. Our username everywhere is TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not chasing the Delaney sisters, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, when I have the time, I can be found all over social media under the name MattRushing02. So if I'm on that platform, you'll find me there. You can also find me here on the network with all of the other shows we're doing with our rewatches, Chris, as well as the 602 Club, as we're talking about all of those franchises we love outside of Star Trek. You can also find me over on the Nerd Party with John Mills talking about Star Wars each and every week on Aggressive Negotiations. And you can find me on Owl Post with Dre Kaufman, as we're talking about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time, and that's a completed show, so enjoy that. But Chris, when you're not trying to figure out how you're going to get into that tequila sunrise corset, where can people find you?
Yeah, it does take some practice, but luckily there are plenty of people on that planet who can teach me how to do it, since everybody knows how. When I'm not doing that, you can find me, as you mentioned, elsewhere on the network doing a lot of shows with you. You can find me in the back catalog on a lot of shows as well, so check those out if you want to hear my thoughts across pretty much the whole spectrum of Star Trek. And then if you want to chat, you can catch me on social media. My username everywhere is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. Blue Sky is where I'm most active these days, but you can find me on all the platforms. So just drop me a note wherever you are. And if you'd like to help us keep this rewatch and everything we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help. It takes a great deal of money to produce and distribute these podcasts, and we would not be here without your support. So thank you to everyone who is helping us now. If you'd like to find out how to support us, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And again, thank you so much to everyone who is supporting us now. All right, Matthew. Well, I'm going to pick up my masks because I think we're going to need them next week to protect us as we discuss Phage.
Well, Chris, I guess that sounds okay. So, I mean, I don't know. Maybe let's just set course for home.